Good morning. My name is Matt Swartz, and I'm a partner in Pillsbury's corporate and M&A practice. I'm an M&A lawyer and a corporate lawyer. The topic for today's discussion is Navigating Rough Seas: Perspectives on the Economy, Investing, and Capital Markets in 2022. Your microphones have been muted, but we encourage you to submit questions in writing. Please feel free to type your questions in the WebEx Q&A box. We will try to address as many of these questions as we can. And finally, we'll be sending you all a copy of the webinar recording after the presentation. We have with us on our panel three very distinguished investors and asset managers. Our panelists combine manage investments valued at tens of billions of dollars on behalf of institutions and individuals, and each has been investing for many, many years. Let me introduce them. First, we have Pat Boyle, Senior Investment Strategist at Bessemer Trust. We also have Vijay Chandar, Executive Director and Market Strategist at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management Investment Resources. And we have Amy Raskin, Chief Investment Officer, Chevy Chase Trust, and frequent guest on CNBC's Fast Money Halftime Report. And in fact, I think Amy will be on CNBC today. Thanks to our event co-sponsors, Kips DeSanto Investment Banking and Cordia Partners. I would also like to thank Chris Pintaro of Bessemer Trust, Frank Vorndren of Morgan Stanley, and Stacy Murchison of Chevy Chase Trust. Let me begin by updating everyone on some key market statistics, the first being stock market performance. Year to date, the S&P 500 has declined 10.4%. Last year, it returned 27%. NASDAQ year to date has declined 16.8%, having returned 26% last year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down to date by 6.3%, and last year it returned 19%. About 160 companies in the S&P 500 are expected to report earnings this week, and all eyes will be on results from the mega cap technology company names, including Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, and Microsoft. As one analyst put it, this week may easily be a fork in the road for equities. Bottom-up drivers will either confirm or reject what the challenging macro backdrop has given us over the last 3 weeks. The inflation rate was 8.5% in March, and that's up 2.6% from a year ago, which is an increase of almost three times. Today's rate of inflation is the highest since 1982. The current U.S. unemployment rate is 3.6%. Last year at this time, it was around 6%. And 2 years ago, in April of 2020, unemployment hit 14.7%, the highest since World War II. The 30-year mortgage has increased every week for the last 7 weeks and now exceeds 5%, an increase from under 3% a year ago, so an increase of 76% in the last year. So we have a very dynamic situation in the markets. And before going into the questions, I want to just observe that the IPO market is down, and the investment bankers are saying they don't want to take companies out into what could be a strong downdraft for a company's initial listing. And specifically, Q1 2022 global IPO transaction numbers fell by 37%, proceeds down 51% year over year. And among those, Asia Pacific accounted for 78% of global IPO proceeds due to mega IPOs that issued from that region. So let me get into the topics we're here discussed. Let's talk about equity markets first, since they're so central to our thinking. Now, historically, the average annual return for U.S. public equities, the S&P 500, is 10%. While 10% might be the average, the returns in any given year are far from average. In fact, between 1926 and 2022, returns were in that average band between 8% and 12% only seven times. So I repeat that. Between 1926 and 2022, the range between 8% and 12% was hit only seven times. Volatility is the state of play in the stock market. But even when the stock market is volatile, returns tend to be positive in a given year. Of course, it doesn't rise every year, but over time, the market has gone up about 70% of years. Frank Vorndren of Morgan Stanley sent me a piece yesterday called Magical Thinking by Morgan Stanley's Lisa Shallet. And I'm going to read it here because it represents one school of thought on the market. It says, or I should say, Lisa wrote, "The stock market is a curious thing. Surely it has seen the ups and downs of the daily churn, but it's been relatively resilient considering the broader context of rather dramatic action in the bond market. We've seen the worst rout in treasuries in 50 years, alongside the most radical pivot in monetary policy in nearly 30 years. Both the 2-year and the 10-year treasury yields have surged, and the market's inflation expectation measures have also jumped. Given all this, one might expect stocks to be in worse shape than they are. But it seems that investors have plowed through these dynamics, keeping the S&P 500 index off its recent low and leaving price multiples basically unchanged. Viewed another way, the equity risk premium, or the extra yield that one can expect by owning stocks over government bonds, has collapsed. What could explain all this?" she asked. She answers, "Equity investors seem to believe at least one of three things. Inflation will be short-lived, earnings will prove more resilient than expected, and global investor flows will still come to the U.S. because it's the best equity market." Lisa Shallett reports that Morgan Stanley's Global Investment Committee considers these assumptions to be, and I'm quoting, "magical thinking." On the other hand, Chris Pintaro of Bessemer sent me the following from Holly McDonald, Bessemer's chief investment officer, and Holly wrote, "While we have moderated our growth estimates for the economy, we continue to believe that the U.S. will grow above trend this year and remain confident in our overweight allocation to the U.S. The main risk to our outlook is the chance that the Fed causes a U.S. recession as it hikes rates and reduces its balance sheet. However," she wrote, "we expect the Fed to adjust its approach as needed." So let me begin with Amy Raskin of Chevy Chase Trust. Amy, are we in a bear market? And if so, what does that mean?
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me, actually. Are we in a bear market? Maybe is the answer to that. But if we are in a bear market, I don't think we are in a deep bear market. And you started off by saying, you know, talking about the returns from last year. If you include dividends, they're even higher. So the S&P returned 29% last year, 18% the year before, and 31% in 2019. So the last 3 years for the equity market have been really, really strong. And almost all of that was driven by, or a lot of that was driven by multiple expansion. And so we're seeing some correction to that this year, as you would expect. I don't remember which report it was that you just cited, but one of them said, that the returns this year were due to sort of lower earnings. I think that was the implication. Earnings are still going up. The returns are coming down due to multiple contraction, which we needed to have. Again, the market had gone too far too fast, was our thinking. And so it was due for some sort of correction. Bear markets tend to be very bad when you're in recession, when the economy declines and you actually have earnings go down. I don't think we're there. I think the Fed could put us there, but that's not our base case. So I do think we're in for volatility. We're in for probably a correction, whether it gets to the technical definition of bear market, down 20%. Maybe, but I don't think we go much further. That wouldn't be probably my base case. I think we're more in correction territory than bear market territory, which is 10%, which we've already passed. But I think that's, I think we're due for some consolidation here, after a very, very strong bull run.
You talked about multiple expansion and multiple contraction, and I just want to confirm what I think that means. Does that mean price relative to the earnings of the company issuing the stock
right.
price relative to, okay.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So PE is the price to earnings. And you would expect that to contract as interest rates go up and inflation is higher. You would expect a lower multiple market. And I think that's what we're getting. And that's completely logical, because as you raise interest rates, the discount rate at which you discount future earnings goes up, and the value of future earnings comes down, and that's what
right.
we're seeing.
And is it, I guess earnings are earnings, but, you know, I guess we'll get to this. I'll save this next thing I was going to ask you for the inflation part of our discussion, but you're going to be on CNBC later today. So can you spoil it for us, please? And I guess the spoiling that I'm going to ask you for is, what do you expect for U.S. equity returns this year? And do you think U.S. equities, non-U.S. equities, are going to be materially different from what U.S. equities return?
You know, for a while, we've been cautious on equities. I do think we would get sort of a high mid to high single digit pullback this year after, again, after very strong, a very strong run. So this is, you know, sort of nothing to that, you know, should set our hair on fire at this point. And again, and I sort of alluded to this, I do think the Fed can ruin it if it wants to. And we'll get a data point about that next week, an important data point. But the Fed has sort of done a complete 180, as have a lot of investors, from not being worried about inflation at all to being very, very worried about inflation to almost the point of not worrying about anything else. So I do think, you know, this isn't, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we sort of went sideways to sideways down for a while. You know, there's an unfilled gap, you know, technically at 4,020 for the S&P. I wouldn't be surprised if we hit that and filled that gap. But I don't think we're in for a correction, you know, anywhere near what we had in 2000 or the global financial crisis. Again, unless there's a big monetary policy error. And as far as international stocks, we were more optimistic about international stocks at the beginning of the year. China shutting down and the Russia-Ukraine war, you know, has really complicated that picture. So right now, I would sort of be sort of market weight international equities. I do think there are some opportunities in specific companies and specific geographies. I tend to look a lot at Japan right now. But the geopolitical picture is complicating international equities at this moment.
Well, more to discuss on that. Pat Boyle of Bessemer Trust, I want to ask you another question, which is maybe somewhat about the present, but really, you know, also about the long term. Pat, do you think that the historical averages for U.S. equities are still good predictors of the future? I mean, we have China's vastly growing presence in many respects, economically, geographically, militarily, monetarily. I mean, they're both India and Israel have now set up sort of direct yuan transactions with China, which they didn't used to have. They went through the dollar before. And of course, there's the massive and growing U.S. government debt. And as we know, and something that causes us all a lot of anxiety, I think, the prospect of, I have to say, global war more realistic than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Do you think that the historical averages for U.S. equities for the S&P 500 is still a good predictor, Pat?
Matt, good to talk to you. Thanks for the invite. I think it's reasonable. We would ratchet that down a little bit. So you had mentioned the figure of 10%, which over the long run has been the total return for U.S. equities. Some of that price appreciation, some of it income from dividends, and I think to the point Amy was making earlier, we've had a really strong run in equities, not this year, but the three prior years. And valuations were a little bit elevated. So prices relative to earnings, just in an absolute basis, looked fairly stretched, which you kind of expected because stocks had done really well and interest rates were so low. And because interest rates were so low, bonds didn't look that attractive. And so a lot of people put money in stocks. They did very well. They bid up prices. And historically, when that's happened, when valuations are a little bit on the high side, and you've also had a very strong run in the last 3 or 4 years, I think it's more likely than not that returns over the next 5 or 10 years, maybe even 15 years, are not quite as good as historical averages. So I think if looking from where we are today, if the historical average is 10, and I need a number to plug in my Excel spreadsheet for the next 5 or 10 years, I think I would feel better about a number closer to 6 or 7 or 8. I think that's more reasonable. But I think somewhere in that range is reasonable. And you mentioned things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and war, and clearly we have a pandemic that hopefully we're on the tail end of. We've got a war, and if you listen to Russia's comments this morning with the nuclear threat, I mean that's really scary stuff. We've got inflation, the Fed tightening, the Fed winding down its balance sheet. But we've also had a lot of really scary stuff over the last 100 years, and the market has survived and done really well. World War I, World War II, the Cold War, Vietnam War, presidential assassinations, and stocks and the American economy have been unbelievably resilient. So I think it will continue to be unbelievably resilient, but we might not be at 10% over the next 5 or 10 years simply because valuations are a little high and we had unbelievably high returns in the 3 years before today.
Very helpful, Pat. And we're going to get into some granularity on that later in our discussion. But let me just take us to a little bit of a side road here, which is, I admit, probably a little more of a personal obsession than I wish, which is China. And say, I'm going to quote Larry Summers, as I think I did last year when we last spoke. I think it has been a year since we've convened this panel. So good to talk to you guys again. Larry Summers, in talking about whether the dollar would be deposed as the world's sort of currency, reserve currency and currency of exchange. And he said, and I'm quoting, "Europe is a museum, Japan is a graveyard, China is a jail, and Bitcoin is an experiment." The reason I've committed that to memory is because it gives me great comfort, and I'm not even sure I know why. And I say that because you look at China, who has a lot of resources, a lot of ambition, and seems to operate by a different set of principles than Western democracies do. So do we need to be afraid that if you look ahead 10, 20 years, that the world economically and the investment kind of matrix looks entirely different because of simply what China's doing and what the West is doing or not doing in response?
Matt, is that this is Pat. Is that one for me or is it for BJ or Amy?
I'd happy I'll offer it to you first, and then if others have thoughts on it, I'd be curious to hear them.
Okay, I'll be short since I just hogged up a bunch of the airwaves. But I think I don't know that I would say it quite the way Larry Summers did, because I'd still want to get invited to some of those countries and see the places. And but if I were running the U.S. government, I would be worried about it. And the way I would think about it is, I want to have the most dynamic, attractive economy for businesses, for employees. I want to have open, liquid, deep financial markets. I want people to want to buy our bonds. I want our currency to be stable and our laws to be straightforward and our immigration policies to be smart. And I know I mentioned a lot there, but I feel like the U.S. competes against every country to be the best place to invest and to be the world's reserve currency. And we still have a big lead. I don't think China or Bitcoin or Europe is going to replace us in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. But I would certainly think of it as a competitive situation, and I would want to do all a lot of the smart things that we've done over the last many years to make our currency the world's reserve currency. And I would keep moving in that direction, but it's not a given. And some of the countries or areas that Larry mentioned that maybe haven't had their stuff together, they could get their stuff together. And China is a better economic competitor. No, I don't think anyone would have thought China would be doing what they are today on the global economic stage had you looked 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. I think it's pretty amazing. So I think we take our eyes off the rest of the world. I think if we do that, that is a big mistake. But fortunately, we have a little bit we have a little bit of time. That's my view.
Matt, I'll jump in. I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think I used that Larry Summers quote on this call last year. So but if anything, I think the past year, China has made itself less realistic as a reserve currency. And I know everybody's getting very concerned about that Saudi deal being priced in renminbi. The Saudi rial is still pegged to the dollar. So even if it's priced in RMB, it's still basically off the dollar. And that probably is not, that's not going to change anytime soon. So there are a lot of things to be concerned about. The dollar losing its reserve currency in the near term, I don't think is one of them. People are very concerned about what, freezing Russia's assets in dollars and what emerging markets are going to do in response to that, because they might be worried that their assets get frozen. Realistically, the China current account deficit is so large that there's just not another market that can handle it. We do own gold in part to take advantage of that, but of all the things to worry about right now, that's probably not high on the list.
Well, thank you, and thank you for supplying me with that quote, which obviously I've taken a lot of comfort from. So, Vijay, I want to ask you, and one way of asking it is, do you guys ever, when you go home for Thanksgiving, actually get to eat, or is everyone bugging you about what should I do about my retirement and my kids' college investment and stuff like that? So this is called the Shandar Family Thanksgiving question, which is, Vijay, what's the near-term risk to traditional equity portfolios? That is, people who are, looking to retire maybe, or at least in the near term. I mean, in the next 3 or 5 years. I mean, if they follow the traditional allocations between debt and equity, is this going to prove to be one of the worst times to retire, like in recent memory? So, what are your thoughts,
Sure.
Vijay?
Sure. So look, and I love that you use 3 to 5 years near term, because I think so many of us get so bogged down in week to week or day to day at this point. But look, I think the last 3 months or 4 months have shown us what the risk is to that traditional portfolio, which is we've lived in a world of very low interest rates and very easy Fed policy. And for the first time in several years, what we saw to start 22 was, as the Fed started getting aggressive in their rhetoric with interest rates, bonds sold off, and bonds sold off alongside equities also selling off, right? And so that traditional 60-40 diversification didn't work in the first quarter. The question is now, how far along are we in that move? If we just kind of think about what a typical Fed tightening cycle looks like, it looks a lot like what we've seen transpire in the equity market to start 22. We came into the year, the S&P 500 was trading close to 22 times price to forward earnings. Today, we're trading close to 18 times. So call it 15 to 20% valuations have come down. That's pretty normal as the Fed starts tightening. And so as we think about the near-term risk going forward, to be honest, I'm a little less concerned about valuation today. I think the market has priced the Fed. I think that's kind of the story that's already happened. I think it's going to be difficult for the Fed to surprise us from here. So to answer your question about near-term risks, in my view, it's less about the Fed. It's less about the PE ratio or valuations. It's actually going to come down to that E, the earnings number. And if there's a risk to watch out for in the hyper near term, meaning the next few months, it's that expectations may still be a little bit too high. And what I'll leave you with is just one of the things we're scratching our heads about, and you quoted my colleague Lisa, sort of magical thinking is, 4 months into this year, we're dealing with commodity price spikes, tight labor market, war, breakdown in global trade, so many things to worry about. Yet during that time, what we've seen is consensus expectations for U.S. corporate earnings on Wall Street have actually been revised higher year to date. That doesn't square with us. And we think this idea that profit margins keep expanding and companies can make up, some of this growth second half of the year, that's the near-term risk. And so I'll just say what we're concerned about in the next several months is just we might have to downgrade expectations a little bit, and that could kick off another leg of the sell-off. But to maybe end on a more positive note, and to get back to your question, if I'm in a retirement account across stocks and bonds, I will say it's rare to see both stocks and bonds sell off together. And so as bad as the first quarter was, as bad as the start to this year has been, while there might be still a little bit more pain, you have had a significant repricing, especially on the fixed income side. And what I like to remind myself and remind clients is the last time it felt this bad with stocks and bonds selling off together was 2018. And that was also at the end of a Fed tightening cycle. What that led to was a period in 2019, which was very strong across both fixed income and equity. So as bad as it feels today, I do think we've done a lot of that repricing, especially in rates and bonds. I think there's a little bit more to go in equities in terms of the earnings outlook, but I don't want to get too negative looking out on your 3 to 5 year timeframe.
Well, thanks, Vijay. Let's talk about inflation, since on everyone's minds. There was a really, I'm not going to compare the U.S. to Argentina, but I have to commend to everyone an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about how people deal with inflation in Argentina, where currently it runs between 4 and 5% per month, not per year. That's just kind of an interesting read. Not that I would expect us to be anywhere near that. But I want to ask Amy, what's causing inflation and what are the prospects of taming it? I mean, we talk about interest rate hikes, and yet we also understand that a huge number of people, I've read, I think 2 million people left the workforce during and after the pandemic, which has led to, or at least been coincident with, a lot labor shortages that drive up wages. And so if that's the problem or a major contributor to it, does increasing interest rates really fix it? So what's causing it? Can we fix it?
That's the critical question. If there's one question that encapsulates everything that you need to kind of know about the market, it's that question. And so I will address the labor in a second, but just in terms of inflation, economists like to distinguish between demand pull inflation and cost push inflation. So demand pull inflation occurs in response to positive demand shocks, and cost push is negative supply shocks. So in order to tell one from the other what's causing inflation, one way you can do it is by looking at real wages. And if real wages are going up a lot, it's probably you have demand pull inflation. That means people have more money and they want to buy more things and they're bidding up the price for those things. That's not what we have, really. We're really having real wages not go up. They're actually not, wages are not actually keeping up with rising prices. So it's a good bet that at least a good portion of our inflation right now is cost push inflation, which is due to supply shortages and other issues, which the Fed really can't control. And there was a long period of time where the Fed was sort of really dragging its feet, saying, we think inflation's transitory, we think it's going to correct itself, we're not going to raise rates, really expeditiously, because inflation is being sort of driven by these other things. And I think the Fed was actually too lackadaisical about it, but now it potentially is swinging too far to the other side to say, we're just going to crush demand to zero. And basically then you don't have to worry about the cost push inflation. That would be a big risk to the economy and to markets. I hope we don't get there, but that's sort of the biggest risk I see out there. The Fed can control demand pull inflation by making things more expensive, by raising rates. I think they need to do that to some degree, but they do have to recognize that they really can't control the cost push inflation, and that's very important. You mentioned people leaving the labor force. So we've actually had 3 million people leave the labor force. And the primary driver of the disinflation, or one of the primary drivers, one of the big drivers of the disinflationary period that we had for basically the 2010s, was the baby boomers working longer than their prior generation. So we sort of had this excess of labor for the last decade, because the baby boomers didn't really retire at 60 like their previous generations did. And now that's turning, and the baby boomers are retiring and they're not going to come back. All these people saying, that they're going to have to and re-enter the labor force. I think the odds of that happening are low. So we are entering a new regime, and we will have the equity market of the 2020s will look very different than the equity market of the 2010s. And the primary driver of that will be the change in inflation and the systemically higher rates. And just also to just touch on your last question, that might not be all that bad for retirees. I mean, one of the big sort of issues of the last decade is people who wanted fixed income could not get any sort of yield on that, on those products. And that will likely change.
Interesting. So no pun intended. So you're saying higher interest rates might be here to stay, kind of?
I think they are here to stay. Yes. I
Okay.
actually think we're going to sort of top out a little bit here for probably maybe the rest of the year or for a few months. I don't, but then, and I think inflation will come down just in terms of compares and sort of supply chain issues getting resolved a little bit and some weakening of demand. But then I do think for the next decade, we are going to be in a systemically higher inflationary environment than we have for the past, for the last decade. And you know, the labor force shrinking is one of the reasons, and the globalization outsourcing really primarily using China as a low source of energy, low cost energy is behind us.
Interesting. So cheap labor from China kind of not having as much a role in the US economy will drive prices up too. Is that fair?
It's cheap labor from China, and but more so, even we use the cheap labor from China, but really what we also used is the coal from China. So we
Gotcha.
had so you know manufacturers had artificially low cost of input cost by using really cheap. By basically outsourcing all their energy needs to China, who didn't have the same greenhouse gas concerns that or climate change concerns that the rest of the world, and that's changing. So,
Gotcha. Very interesting. Okay, Pat, well, this is a perfect segue. Pat, what do you think are the opportunities and maybe the risks of, investing in a high inflation environment, and I suppose a higher interest rate environment?
yeah, I think I think some are unique and some are kind of the normal risk you deal with every day in the financial markets. But as far as opportunities, cash is a pretty lousy long-term asset class to hold, period, and it's even worse in a high inflation environment. Bonds historically have not kept up with inflation, so that kind of pushes you more to equities. And equities, and I apologize, I've got a little ambulance traffic outside my office, but if the economy is growing and you have higher inflation historically, as long as it's under control, 3 or 4% or maybe even just slightly higher, historically the equity markets have done okay. I think the risk is if your crystal ball told you that you're going to have higher inflation and a really lousy economy that's not growing, that is a big risk. And if you had a good crystal ball and it said that, you would probably want to cut your equity weights. That is not our base case at all. And in fact, even though inflation is uncomfortably high now, earnings are still growing, revenues are still growing. They grew a lot last year. Now, last year we had very easy comparisons against the year before. But I think, Matt, you had said it so far, maybe a quarter of the S&P companies have reported. And if you look at what they've already reported in revenues and then what's expected, revenue growth is around 12%, and so that's not stagflation at all. And maybe I just would end on one positive thing, just to maybe reinforce something Amy said. If you bought bonds January 1st of this year, and you looked at your statement today, it's not a pleasant viewing because interest rates have gone up, and in the short run, when rates go up, it's not great for bond holders because, as we know, the prices go down. So rates go up, bond prices go down. But over the intermediate or longer term, it's actually good for you as a bond investor because you get to reinvest your coupons if you're not spending them at higher rates. And as bonds in your portfolio mature, you get to reinvest those maturing bonds at higher rates as well. So even though inflation is not great for bond returns, as long as inflation stays reasonably under control and the economy continues to grow, higher interest rates aren't all that bad for bond investors. Although, as this quarter reminds us, in the short run, higher rates are very painful for bond investors.
so it's interesting, and I guess I'll segue to Vijay a question based on what Pat just said, which is, so we have earnings reports from companies fairly early in this inflationary period, meaning we don't have a lot of inflationary quarters behind us, at least not at current levels. And so one of the questions is, are companies going to be able to pass their extra costs from labor or from supply on to consumers kind of without limit, And so if the answer is no, which of course there's a limit somewhere, then earnings get compressed, right? And so I guess, and Vijay, I suppose this probably goes right into what Lisa Shalit wrote. What is your view? Do you think that we're going to get inflation under control? And if not, how can it not have a pretty negative effect on the value of equities and a corresponding, and Pat was just talking about interest rates. If you're not living on the interest, you can always reinvest it and get a higher rate. But are there any winners in this inflation, I guess? And is there any way that if it goes on, earnings aren't compressed?
Sure. So I think there's a few things there. So I'll try to be brief. But look, I think second half of last year into the first quarter of this year, you talk to companies, all of them were saying inflation's not a problem because we're passing it along and we're not seeing any type of buyer strike. That's starting to change. And so we think we're at that tipping point here as we go into the second quarter, maybe it's third quarter, but we're at that point now where we think inflation's no longer going to be purely a good thing because companies can pass it along and have high sales drop to high profits. We think we're now at the point where inflation's going to start presenting margin risk. We're already hearing that from some companies where sales are still decent, but volume of what's being sold is going down, right? And so you are seeing a little bit of a pushback. And so we'd argue that you kind of summarize the risk pretty well, which is this expectation that margins stay elevated or even keep expanding in the second half of the year. That's the risk. And to be clear, it's not necessarily even a recession risk. What we're talking about is maybe a 3 to 5% type hit to earnings, but that matters on the margin. In terms of can the Fed get inflation under control or can inflation get under control? I think what does it mean to get inflation under control? We think the Fed's bogey is probably going to be 3%. I don't think we're going to get there this year, given what's going on with commodity prices. We think we'll get there early next year because keep in mind, we're looking at inflation on a year-over-year basis, right? So all that inflation we had middle and late last year and all the inflation we have to start this year becomes next year's base effect. We do think we'll be back under 3 on CPI probably by early next year. But we do ultimately think we're going to be stuck in a higher inflationary environment this cycle, like Amy mentioned. And so, one of our favorite things to include in asset allocation has been real assets, things like commodity-oriented business, real estate, essentially assets where you have some type of cash flows that reprice with inflation. We think those type of exposures are still a good place to be, albeit again, we do think inflation's peaking here. We do think we'll get back below 3%, probably not till next year. But that level is still going to be high, even if rate of change decelerates.
Interesting. Okay. And
And
so you,
wait, Matt, can
sorry,
I
go
just
ahead,
jump
Amy.
in on one thing on that? Typically, I know it sounds very logical that inflation would lead to lower margins. Typically, it hasn't. What the biggest impact on margins is top line growth. If you're still growing top line, companies tend to actually be able to either maintain or expand margins. It's when the top line goes down that you really see margins sort of get crushed. So it really is, it's until interest rates really are high enough to crimp demand, which we're probably a decent way from that. It's probably a little too early to worry about extensive margin compression for the S&P overall.
All right, Amy, so you asked for it. How high do you think interest rates are going to get?
Long rates or short rates?
Give me both.
I think you probably get the long, the 10-year probably hits 3, goes maybe a little bit over that, and then sort of stops for a while. I think the Fed probably stops, after 6 or 7, rate hikes. I think the market's pricing in 10 right now. I think that's too high. I don't think we go there in the next 12 months. And if we do, I think I if we do, I do think we have a recession and probably a deep one.
Okay, Vijay, Pat, the bid on the table is 3% peak for 10-year rates. You guys see it differently?
I don't. I mean, I think getting a peak in the long end right around this next Fed meeting or June makes a lot of sense. So I think we're in agreement there.
Yeah, I think that sounds pretty reasonable. And you know, investors worry because you read the headlines and the headlines say the Fed's hiking rates, the Fed's hiking rates, and that's all true, but we think a lot of that is already priced into the 10-year treasury.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's not shockingly higher than where we are now, right? I mean, so maybe am I hearing from the panel that concern over rising and rising and rising interest rates might be slightly overblown?
I think what I think we're all saying is that, look, we've gone really far really fast. I think we started the year with the 10-year at like 1.68 or something like that. So to be at 2.9, 2.8, 2.9, especially in percentage terms, we've had a big run. And I do think it could go, I mean, could we get to 3.25? Of course. But I think, I do think it makes sense for it to sort of consolidate around here for a while till we're going to get a lot of data and to sort of, we've been talking a lot about inflation going two steps up, one step down, then two steps up. And so, you tend not to have things just move in a straight line, in perpetuity. And I think that's what we're saying. So I do think we'll get some sort of consolidation. But the biggest risk is, the Fed over-tightening. Because they're reacting too much to inflation. And then, of course, they forget about their other mandate, which is employment, and which would start going the other way. If the faster they raise rates on the short end, counterintuitively, that should lower the longer end because that's sort of just taking away economic growth in the long term.
So I don't, it's interesting. So when the panel seems to agree that, excuse me, we're in a longer term higher interest rate environment, it's kind of a moderately higher interest rate environment. Is that fair?
I think we can get significantly higher in 2023 and 2024. I think we got to get there first.
And Matt, that's on the longer end, but we've been in a zero short-term interest rate environment, and if you go from 0% at your Citibank checking account and all of a sudden you're at one or one and a half, which maybe you'll be someday, but the Fed funds rate might end up at two or two and a half or in that range. That's a huge change.
Right, it is, and I don't mean to diminish its significance in percentage terms, but historically, compared to say interest rates over the last 50 years, if you look at what mortgages cost even in the 90s, right? I mean, it's still relatively low, right?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, and that's you didn't ask it, but I'll tell you anyway. That's one of the reasons that we're reasonably optimistic about the economy and the stock market. And I think the panelists have talked about a lot of risks. We're looking and worried about the pandemic and inflation and the war and margins and all of that. But we're still re reasonably optimistic on the economy, because even when rates go up, they will still be low. They're not going to be low relative to where they were a year ago, but look at the 50-year chart for the 10-year treasury. I think we're still going to look re very good and very stimulative if low rates are stimulative, which they are, compared to much of the long-term history.
So I'm going to ask a couple of wonky questions and ask you for as quick an answer so that I can, demonstrate my empathy with our audience who may not want to hear such wonkiness. But here are my wonky questions, and whoever wants to answer them. The first one is, if you assume the predictions that you've made in interest rates, one of the things that matters very broadly in the United States, but especially here in the Washington region, is how the change in interest rates affects government spending. So, we see it, a lot of government services companies around here can pass on their labor costs to government, but then that takes up a bigger share of the budget, meaning if the government doesn't increase budgets for some of the programs that government contractors are supporting, that there just won't be as many programs. And that's a microcosm of its effect across the US. And, as interest rates go up, interest on our debt goes up, which means the portion of the U.S. budget that just goes to paying interest goes way up. So do any of the changes that you think are within the kind of reasonable probability have a meaningful effect on U.S. government operation, borrowing, and interest payments?
Yeah, maybe I'll just start it and be brief. I think they do. I think, and I can't remember if we talked about this last time or not, but the U.S. debt and deficit spending for quite a while, it is a bit of a cumulative problem with super low interest rates. I think the market can kind of look away, but as interest rates go up and we have to refinance that debt because I think the average maturity of our government debt is, last I checked, somewhere around 5 or 6 or maybe slightly more than 6 years. You're going to have to refinance a lot of debt at higher rates. And that just makes our budget problems worse. So I think it's an issue. I don't think it's an issue that investors will focus on tomorrow or in a month or 3 months. And it's not something that will cause a bear market, but it will definitely add some pressure to Washington. I don't know if it changes how money gets spent, but it's a longer term risk.
Okay, let me Vijay and or Amy, you know, we're getting into the super wonky here, but there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was yesterday, about the sort of surprising broader effect of the weakening of the Japanese yen against the U.S. dollar. And I read it, and I can't say I understood it completely. So I wonder if you could tell me if you think it's important and just briefly explain, if so, how.
Sure, I'll take it. So, I mean, the yen has been dramatically weak against all currencies year to date, especially the dollar. The dollar's been strong, broadly speaking, against other currencies. And I think the dollar's been strong for some fairly right reasons, which are the expectation is the market's taking the Fed serious about rate hikes. To use Japan as kind of a juxtaposition, Japan's not really tilting hawkishly while the rest of the world does. You know, they're committed to very similar policies to what they had last cycle. And so the world's essentially saying, if I've got interest rates going higher in the U.S. this year, if I've probably got rates going higher in Europe, you know, middle of this year or late this year, and Japan's not going to do anything, then the currency is going to weaken. Now, the second thing, which I think is affecting a lot of countries, not just Japan, is as a major commodity importer, obviously the spike in commodity prices put pressure on them. So do I think it has broad implications for U.S. investors? Not really. I think if you own, you know, investments in Japan, you do have to think about hedging the currency risk, although at this point, so much is already priced that we probably wouldn't do so. But I think it really just underscores how dramatic this Fed pivot has been. You know, even if we just look at the dollar broadly and the strength we've seen, you know, the dollar's up more than 10% in the last 12 months. You know, I think that's a direct reflection of what the Fed's message here has shifted.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to go to Japan this summer. I think if anybody wants to go, they should plan their trip now. I think the yen's back to like 2002 levels. And Japan's trying to, you know, this is their way of trying to get their inflation numbers higher, and it will probably work, and it will be sort of self-correcting. I mean, as you alluded to earlier, that what people are all abuzz now about is there's been a 2 standard deviation move for like each of the last few days in the renminbi going down against the dollar as well. The higher interest rates are causing the dollar to go up. I do think that will sort of reverse in the second half of the year, especially if the Fed backs off a little bit. There are all sorts of financial market implications. They are kind of wonky. But to your first question, the higher rates, you know, the only sort of part of our economy that has excessive levels of debt right now, it's not the consumer, it's not the corporation, it is the government, and it's going to crowd out other spending. And that's part of the reason why interest rates won't go up as much as some people are forecasting right now. It's just the government can't afford it.
Thank you. I do want to talk about bonds, but I think I'll save it until the end. Let's go to the recession question, and I'll ask Pat first. Do you think we'll have a recession this year, and what about next year? Well, what's your guess?
Yeah, and I think guess is a good word. I appreciate that, Matt. I think it's good to always think about how often we're in a recession, and the economy seems to be in a recession somewhere around 15% of the time. So you have a recession that lasts 6 months or 9 months or maybe a little longer. And then you have an expansion for 4 or 5 years. The most recent expansions have been a lot longer than that. So I think you just have to always think about, well, what's the base case? And if the world is kind of normal and you don't have a strong opinion, you'd probably say the odds of a recession in any 1 year are something like 15%. I think there may be a little, maybe they're a little higher than that because of what's going on with interest rates and inflation, and also the war in Ukraine and Russia, which poses a little risk that's hard to quantify. But we still think low. So we're investing in equities. We're comfortable investing in equities. We have slightly more in equities than we do in bonds, because even though there are a lot of risks that we've all talked about, we think the odds of a recession are low. At some point, if the Fed keeps hiking aggressively and overdoes it and doesn't focus on the labor market and just hikes and hikes and hikes, a recession is possible, but it seems unlikely in the next 12 months. And this is a guess, but you know, maybe it's 3 or 4 years out, but it a lot depends on what happens between now and then, what the Fed does. So that's definitely a guess.
Okay. Vijay, any contrary thoughts?
No, I'd say, look, I still think risk of recession this year is low. I think next year has certainly risen, although shouldn't be the base case. And I would just watch the labor market. You know, I mean, if you look at just the unemployment rate, it looks like we're later in the cycle. If you look at employment to population, so kind of baking in labor force participation rate, it could suggest maybe we are a little bit more mid-cycle. But there's a lot of flexes there. So if we don't get people off the sidelines in the labor force, we're probably a lot closer to a recession today. But still don't think that's 22 or even 23 as a base case at this point.
Any disagreement, Amy?
No.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go now to this feels like almost sacrilegious, but I'm going to ask Vijay to address a Morgan Stanley report entitled, "Are Private Equity's Best Days Gone?" So I'm going to read the sort of summary of that report, and I'm quoting, "We believe the historic decade of double-digit returns for limited partners in private investment funds, and in particular private equity, is coming to an end. The perfect storm of Federal Reserve financial repression and negative real borrowing rates, low valuations, capital-light business models, and easy credit markets has given way to extended business cycle pressures. Rich public market and purchase valuations, all-time high corporate leverage, deteriorating credit protections, falling interest rate coverage, weakening in economic growth, and more than $2 trillion of dry powder, that is, funds committed but not yet invested, suggest that the best days for private equity are behind us." So is this your position, Vijay?
Well, I'll say, I think we could probably say the best days across a lot of asset classes are behind us. You know, when you look at some of the reasons we outlined in that report, a lot of them apply to public equities too, right? And so I think really what we're trying to get at here, and what we talk to asset allocators about, is private equity has been a very popular place to be. And within the context of capturing an illiquidity premium, we still think you will. But if we're forecasting public equity returns to be lower, given the run we've had, which you started at the top of this conversation, given where valuations are, then ultimately our feeling is private equity returns are also going to be lower. If we try to forecast that out, our latest forecast is actually still pretty healthy. We have a global equity, you know, return forecast of 5%, and we think the liquidity premium we'll get on top of that will be about 3%. And so it's not that we're saying private equity is going to go down. It's just simply with more assets chasing deals, we do think that relative premium starts to contract. And if your starting point of public equity returns is going to be lower, given where we are, we think private equity returns will also be lower. How does that impact how we manage money? You know, as we'd always say, rather than allocate to private equity as an asset class in a more challenging environment, you just really want to make sure you're doing due diligence on who you're allocating with.
Interesting. Okay, so Chevy Chase Trust. Do you think private equity, their best days are behind them, Amy?
Yes. I mean, I sort of agree, at least in the short term. I think, you know, if we get when we do have a recession, there'll be a lot of opportunities for, them to use that $2 trillion of dry powder and probably buy companies, at a good attractive price. So maybe not behind them forever, but right now, yeah, as interest rates are going up, that's not a great backdrop for private equity.
So Bessemer Trust, Pat Boyle, you're at that Thanksgiving table that I mentioned at VJ's house, though this one is at the Boyle house, and someone's saying, private equity, it's time to get in. I need my chance here. What's your answer?
Well, if it's my family member, I tell them they don't have enough money to qualify. But let's just say one of my family members had a guest. I would say similar to what VJ said, maybe with slightly more upbeat numbers, but not all that different. If good private equity returns in the last decade have been, and clearly they're all over the board, but if good returns have been 15 or 20, I think 15 or 20 for a diversified portfolio is going to be much harder to come by for all the reasons that Vijay said. However, I still think that if you've got a good process and good manager selection and you're with the right managers, I think you should significantly outperform the public equity markets. And I would still expect double-digit returns in private equity over the next 5, 10, 15 years. We have been investing in private equity and venture for a long, long time, and when I chat with the managers and also some of our clients who run private equity and venture firms, just the stuff that they continue to see and the innovation and the technology, I think is really, really exciting and cool and will lead to good returns. But is there some froth there now? Absolutely. Just like there has been in a lot of asset classes.
Okay, interesting. I mean, it's an interesting dynamic that we see on the ground because one of the complaints I hear from private equity funds, particularly middle market private equity funds, is that all that dry powder creates tremendous competition that drives prices up, which in turn, when private equity funds buy companies, increases the expectation of the amount they've got to sell their portfolio companies for to make a return. So I'm sure the private equity funds will be pleased by the multiple compression that Amy was talking about at the beginning. There's so much money out there, though, it's hard to see how that doesn't have an overall effect on reducing their returns. And I guess we'll see. I guess I want to ask you guys, and maybe we can again start with Pat and then Amy and then Vijay. In the last part of this time that we have, where should people be putting their money? And we haven't really talked about the bond market, and I don't mean to suggest that's where people should be putting their money, but maybe it makes sense just as a part of that. And I will add before I invite you guys to answer the question, there was a time at the end of last year, I think, when people were saying, with interest rates going up, look at investing in lenders, basically, because they can pass those interest rate costs along profitably. And yet in the first quarter, we saw the earnings reports from the big banks and financial institutions not doing as well. And I don't think that was so much a surprise, although I'd be interested in your thoughts. So realize we have a little less than 15 minutes, but this is an important question, which is what are the opportunities now? Where are you guys seeing them? And Pat, I'll invite you to go first.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Well, I think, and this is going to sound boring, but I actually believe it. I think it's a bad idea for most investors to try to overthink the markets and overreact to what's gone on. And it would be very easy reading the headlines today to talk yourself out of owning bonds or to say, look, the Fed is hiking and we've got this war and inflation is high. I got to get out of the equity markets. I think we're all humans, and it's the tendency, I think, is to overreact to news. And so I would say to investors, and again, I know this is boring. Let's get back to your asset allocation. What when you set it up with your financial advisor, whether it's any of the firms that are on the panel right now, what was it? It was probably some mix of cash and bonds and stocks, and maybe for wealthier clients, some, you know, that could include hedge funds or private equity and venture capital or real assets. And if that still makes sense over the long run, I don't think I would have any reason to push the panic button right now. It's too late to get out of bonds and look super smart. And I think equity returns are likely to be positive over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And same with venture capital and private equity, and even better than equity returns. Now, all that said, we are, you know, gravitating a little bit more to the U.S. and a little bit away from Europe and emerging markets. And within the U.S., we are diversified and have exposures to value and growth and all different industries. But we're still a little bit more weighted to technology and healthcare and consumer, which has been very helpful over the last couple of years, but has cost us a little performance this year as some of the tech stocks have sold off more than, say, like the energy stock. So that's kind of where our head's at right now, Matt.
Okay, Amy, where are you guys at Chevy Chase Trust seeing opportunities in, you know, what is feels like a pretty volatile market with, you know, some trends that are kind of emerging?
Sure. So we, in the fourth quarter of 2020, we went very overweight energy and commodities, and that proved to be a very good call. And I still think, you know, we've trimmed some recently just because they got to be such a big part of the portfolio. But I still think that's, you know, that's the right, one of the right places to be, certainly in an inflationary environment. We're still not putting a lot of, not putting a lot of CapEx into the energy sector. Once we come out of the pandemic globally, you know, I think there's, and, you know, the war will end at some point. You're going to get good returns there. Those stocks are still really cheap. They're still a really small percentage of the S&P right now, and they could get a lot bigger. I'm amazed at how many of my counterparts I talk to who say, you know, they just won't touch energy no matter what, because of social responsibility concerns. We're not at a world, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it, but that, you know, ambulances still run on oil. You're still going to need oil, and you need that to be. So somehow we're going to have to figure out how to square that circle. The other place that obviously we're thematic investors, so we have a bunch of themes that we think are, you know, really well positioned for the next decade. One area that I think is particularly attractive right now is biotech. Biotech relative to R&D is trading, you know, sort of at cap ratios near where semiconductors were in 2013 before they went on that long, long run, and very steep run. So you can invest in a lot of biotech companies now that have had significant R&D expenses and are really well positioned at pretty attractive prices. And we think there'll be specific investments in that sector that do really well. We're invested in gold, again, another sort of inflation play. We're sort of more neutral on the financials right now. And I think the place that you really don't want to be actually is are sort of still the overvalued tech companies. And I think, you know, they got their last hurrah during the pandemic. And you kind of saw that from Netflix, you know, where everybody decided to upgrade their technology and spend, you know, buy a new phone and spend money on, you know, making their home office work. And I think that's going to reverse itself. Probably travel is not something that we're playing right now, but probably also good in the short term. You either have to be looking at the markets and be willing to shift, because I do think we're going to have a lot of volatility in the coming years, or have to have somebody who can do that for you.
Did you say travel, Amy?
Airlines, hotels.
But let me ask you this question. You mentioned energy just as one example, but these things are changing every day. So you read, you know, Warren Buffett just took a position in Hewlett Packard, or I should say, you know, Berkshire Hathaway did. And when you hear that, it makes you think, well, maybe that was a great investment when Warren Buffett made it, or maybe not, I'm not saying. But, you know, a month later, is it all built in? So the themes that you're mentioning are still good opportunities in your mind.
Yes. I mean, our themes tend to be very long-term focused. You know, Warren Buffett is more opportunistic and more valuation sensitive. And, you know, certainly his investing style works for him. And we own Berkshire. I think that's a good play. Like he might have more opportunities to take advantage of. But our themes are multi-year themes. And so in the end of 2020, we, you know, still were in the pandemic. We put an end of disinflationary tailwinds theme in our portfolio to try to take, you know, advantage of the inflation that we saw coming. And that as a theme has worked out very well for us. And I still think that has legs, although, you know, we've pared back just because it has worked so well.
So Vijay Shandar, we talked early in our discussion today about Morgan Stanley's piece called Magical Thinking. So what thinking is not magical? Give me some non-magical opportunities that exist in today's environment.
Sure. So look, first I'll just say we think now is a time very similar to, I think, what Pat just said, is it's a time to look like your strategic allocation or target, right? We're not seeing a whole lot of fat pitches right now. And so we've been of the mindset and environment where we do think there's two-way risk and it's hard to have a lot of conviction. You want to kind of swing back towards target and give yourself the chance to take more risk later. That being said, if you're more near-term oriented, we don't think investment-grade bonds are a bad place to be. You know, we haven't pitched bonds in years, but in this type of environment where we think equity volatility is going to be a little bit higher, where we can actually start to generate some decent yields, you know, without taking too much risk, we don't think it's a bad place to hide, you know, the next several months or quarters. Long term, you know, I'd agree entirely with Amy. I think you want to think about how the world is going to change and how this cycle is going to look different from the past cycle. Our view is this next cycle, for a number of reasons, is going to lead to more investment across the world. We're going to have a little bit of breakdown in terms of global relations. That's ultimately going to be inflationary, but it also should kick off a CapEx cycle. And I think a lot of countries and companies are already thinking about, you know, where are they short? And so this idea that we could invest in more, you know, domestic energy production or around the world, countries investing more, you know, making up for the lack of a CapEx cycle we had last time, more domestic semi-manufacturing, things of that nature, all of this is going to lead to opportunities. Our favorite way to play this structurally remains real assets, right? It's kind of a play on higher nominal GDP that encompasses a lot of these sectors. But I think that's where you want to be thinking. And the final thing I'll just say, and I think I said it before, is look, if we have another quarter or if 22 ends up looking more like the first quarter where stocks and bonds sell off together, it's not going to last forever. And so ultimately, valuations start to get more reasonable. And as cautious as we are, you know, in the next few months, I do think coming out of this, you get a little bit of a reset and there will be a lot of opportunity again. We just want to be patient about deploying into that.
Very interesting. And I encourage each of you to, you know, read the materials that Chevy Chase Trust and Bessemer and Morgan Stanley put out. It's highly valuable stuff. Before I thank our panelists for their great contribution, I just want to observe, and I hope the audience will share my sorrow, that when I mentioned Thanksgiving twice, none of you said, but at our table, we really need a good deal lawyer. So I'm just saying, you know. So I would like to thank Amy Raskin of Chevy Chase Trust, Pat Boyle of Bessemer, and Vijay Shandar of Morgan Stanley. Thank you all so much. As always, very interesting and dynamic environment, and we're very lucky to have your thoughts.